The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
From the studios of the Shepherd Radio Network, it's Afternoons with Mike. This next hour is all about our walk with Jesus, with local pastors, newsmakers, people who are making a difference for the gospel. Now, here is your host, Mike Gilland.
And we welcome you back to our program Afternoons with Mike on this special edition, this being the third of our series of four episodes, drawing awareness to and kind of signaling the problem that is happening, and now it's at an epidemic level. That problem is opioids. Opioid use in America has been skyrocketing in recent years, and I've got along with me a couple of colleagues from our studio here today, J.C. Derrick, who is the publisher of our Main Street Daily News up in Gainesville. Also, Brittany Parks, who is our Director of Development for The Shepherd. They've been joining me for these special episodes. And, you know, there are recent things are happening. Even since we began this program, new figures are out, JC, right?
That's right. Yeah, this week, the CDC, they released preliminary numbers on a 12-month rolling basis. And just this week, they announced that for the 12-month period from September 2019 through September 2020, 87,000 Americans, an estimated 87,000, died from drug overdoses. And I mean, that's just a staggering number. It's up 27%. And is really, according to the New York Times, they actually reported that it eclipsed the toll from any year since the opioid epidemic began in the 1990s.
Wow. 27%. And, you know, this is a shocking thing when we talk to Sheriff Lima from Seminole County. We had an opportunity to talk with him, and he said pre-COVID, this is now before the COVID crisis. Mm-hmm. He said it was 19 Floridians dying every day, 19 dying. And that is just an amazing amount of number of our citizens that we're losing. Some have said it this way, we're losing a generation. And, you know, he also talks about, and he's going to be our first speaker today, Brittany, he also talked about something that you've mentioned on the program before, the drug called Narcan.
Absolutely. Sometimes you'll hear about it called Naloxone. It's sold under the name of Narcan. It is a medication people call the Lazarus drug. It brings you back to life if you've overdosed. Sometimes you may have to put one or two pumps into someone's nose. It's a nasal spray that does a reaction with your brain and brings you back. And I encourage everyone to go to their local pharmacy and purchase Narcan. If you have a Tylenol or bandages, if someone gets stabbed or hurt, the number one thing you want by replacing medication is putting Narcan, because you never know how you can save someone's life. That's 87,000 Americans that could have been saved by having Narcan in their home.
So there are basically two things that we're doing in this series that are real actionable items that every person listening can do. Number one is take part in National Drug Take Back Day, which is coming up next week. It's going to be on the 24th, that's Saturday, and we'll have on our Facebook page locations where you can do that in the communities where the Shepherd stations operate. So that's number one. We can all take part in that. And what does that mean? That means going through medicine cabinets, kitchen cabinets, wherever you might store prescription drugs, because we're finding out that many times and in many families, family members are partaking of drugs that they find in these cabinets. Unused drugs, the person for whom they were prescribed, they're not taking them anymore, but they're often being used. That's number one. Number two, this thing called Narcan.
Narcan's going to save someone's life, so you better have it in your house.
All right, so that's the second item. This is new to a lot of people. Right now, we're going to hear from the sheriff of Seminole County. His name is Dennis Lima. Just about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, the Attorney General in Florida, Ashley Moody, named Sheriff Lima as chair of the Transition Advisory Committee Working Group on Opioid Abuse. That's a long title for a very big problem. And we are so grateful to have you, sir, and the improvement that you've already made in so many areas on this abuse situation that's happening in our fine state of Florida. But it's happening all over the world, isn't it?
It, it was a huge problem before COVID-19. COVID-19 has only complicated the problem because people have turned to their substance at a higher rate than ever before. And, yeah. you know, recovery is very much a social type of environment that, that kind of surrounds that loved one and, you know, lean on each other. So the numbers are skyrocketing right now. But before COVID-19, we were losing 19 people a day in the state of Florida alone. And for the first time in more than 100 years, the average life expectancy of a U.S. citizen was diminished because of this unprecedented opioid epidemic. I think that now anyone who studied the history of this knows that, you know, the Sackler family and Purdue Pharmaceutical, you know, came out with that wonder drug. And there was a problem with overprescribing, particularly OxyContin, across our country. And Florida was really the hub of that. At one point in time, 97% of the prescription pills that were on the streets were prescribed at one of the 950 pill mills in our state. Mm. And, you know, when we worked with, at the time, Governor Rick Scott and Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi to close those clinics down and to create a prescription pill monitoring system, we already had unprecedented numbers of addiction. By the way, 80% of the individuals were introduced to the opioid simply because they were following the doctor's orders.
Yeah, prescription drugs being a gateway to this. And you mentioned something even before we started recording this call, that oftentimes people will order what they think are the same milligram and the type of drug milled the same way, and oftentimes find out that it's completely different than what they think they're getting.
But, you know, it's nothing but a pure counterfeit. We know that the drug fentanyl, that has a great application as a medicine, but in the illicit drug trade, it is a fraction of the cost instead of the organically grown opioids and poppy plants. And it's processed in clandestine labs or medications people's bathrooms. But we know fentanyl is 100 times more potent than morphine and 50 times more potent than heroin. And then the introduction of carfentanil and a series of other synthetic opioids, carfentanil, a microgram of carfentanil or the equivalent of 8 grains of salt is a lethal dose. So as people are going and ordering up the drugs that they have become familiar with through the overprescribing, and they think that I can get 80 milligram OxyContin, they're getting counterfeit pills that are cut in clandestine labs, pressed in a pill press. And they're overdosing and dying almost immediately.
Wow. You are in a unique place. I know that, again, Attorney General Ashley Moody named you to this committee in 2019. Later that same year, our First Lady, Casey DeSantis, announced that a formation of a drug abuse prevention panel was being formed and that you were serving as a chair. So it's very clear that you've been put into a position of maximum influence, and we are grateful, sir, for what you're doing. As you look at this, and your aim is to find ways that you can draw attention to, which is part of what this series is aiming at doing, and also to really find out what would be the best practices that we could employ. What are you finding as you're diving into this and seeing it at ground level?
Well, I think the first thing that we have to do is change the face of addiction. And quite frankly, I mean, a lot of us that have not experienced it ourselves don't know much about addiction. I think that the narrative for many, many years was the campaign on Simply Say No to Drugs. And, you know, one of the things that we know is opioids are one of the most addictive properties that are present. And many of the people who had started this legitimate opioid regimen because they had a pre-existing medical condition have become what we call dope sick. And what's happening is when somebody, and a lot of people don't understand this, but when somebody takes an opioid, whether it's synthetically manufactured or organically grown, it goes through the body, immediately attaches to the mu receptors in the brain, and it tells the body to shut off. In many cases, they're saying, you know what, you've been working hard, you know, turn your lungs off and turn your heart off. Mm. And law enforcement officers and public safety professionals have really just in recent years been talking about the benefits of opioid antagonists, most time referred to in its manufactured name of Narcan. But Narcan goes to the body. It's a nasal inhaler. It attaches to those same mu receptors in the brain and actually saves people's lives up to 90 minutes. I give you an example. In Seminole County alone, one of the very affluent counties in the state of Florida, the third most densely populated, you know, 500,000 people in a little over 300 square miles, we had 741 overdoses last year. Public safety professionals deployed Narcan 650 times, or another way to say it, brought people back to life 650 times. And then sadly, about 109 deaths last year alone.
Are you seeing any change positive in this at all?
The only positive change that we're having here in Seminole County is that although there is a significant increase in the overdoses, even year to date from last year, from those numbers that I just gave you, there's actually an increase in overdoses, but the overdose deaths remain flat, which means as people continue to turn to their substance of choice, and these numbers are not unique just to Seminole County, they're across the state. They're across the country. Some areas of the country have a larger meth problem. But at least we're getting people access to the gold standard of treatment of this, and that's MAT. And there's three forms of FDA-approved medicine to treat opioid use disorder, and that's probably the most widely known is methadone. That's been around for a very long time.
Yes.
There's also buprenorphine, which is an opioid base, an opioid antagonist drug. And then the last is Vivitrol. So I think that combining cognitive behavioral therapy and then medicine to treat opioid use disorder, we're making some progress. And, you know, one of the things that I have used my voice for and our team's voice for, and I know that the governor, the attorney general, the first lady, all are strong ambassadors and advocates of this, is this is not a situation in most cases of trying to make bad people good, but rather sick people well. And it needs to be treated as a clinical problem. You intercept and interrupt the demand by getting people clean, and then the supply by making sure that we hold the drug dealers accountable to the fullest extent of the law. And in Seminole County alone, we've charged more drug dealers with first-degree murder for dealing deadly doses of narcotics in any other county in the state.
That's an amazing statistic as well. What do you see as being the number one aim when it comes to the source of these drugs that are particularly the kind of drugs that are laced with fentanyl?
Well, it's profit is what it is. I mean, these drug dealers, at one time it was being manufactured in China and then sent over to other countries that had easier access to our country. Now there's a lot of clandestine labs that are set up just south of the border in Mexico. In some cases, it's mailed in through the U.S. mail. Other times, it's carried across the border with coyotes and drug cartels that are coming in. But what's unique about fentanyl is it's easy to process. It is a tenth of the cost of the organically grown heroin through poppy plants. It's just extremely deadly, very powerful, and easy to manufacture.
Mm-hmm. What's your greatest hope, sir, as you look forward past 2021 and maybe even post-COVID as we get to that point? What's your greatest hope in terms of a demarcation point that will let you know that the aims and the direction that you're taking us is hitting a goal?
Yeah, I think we're getting there. You know, I think that the first step was to change the face of addiction and dependency, and I think that we're doing that. I think that when we come out of COVID and people are vaccinated and they're no longer fearful of their own health, it'll allow us as a society to focus on, I would argue, our greatest responsibility has always been to protect and preserve human life. You know, we've got incredible opportunities here through a public-private partnership, one specifically with Advent Health, the creation of the first of its kind Hope and Healing Center that is located directly across from our correctional facility and next to our main sheriff's office headquarters. But it's a state-of-the-art facility that accepts any patient in any family member that is navigating a path and a course towards recovery. They accept people regardless of whether or not they have insurance or they're underinsured. And not only do they provide medical assisted treatment and cognitive behavioral therapy, but they also have a residential component for those people who are in critical crisis, where they can be there and receive services. One of the interesting things to highlight here is the number one predictor of whether or not somebody will overdose and die is whether or not they've overdosed in the past and survived. And for many hospital groups, when they treat people who are in crisis that overdose and that are stabilized through the use of an opioid antagonist, ultimately they release them back out into the community that they just overdosed in, increasing their likelihood of overdosing and dying within the first 12 months by more than 800 times. So what we do here in this county is respond to every overdose situation immediately. And we do that in partnership with Advent Health and help people kind of get down the path towards recovery. What's interesting is all of the things that we're doing here did not cost the taxpayers a dime. When we started it, Walmart came into my office and gave me $500,000 and came back with a commitment of $250,000 for this year. So that's really, truly a public-private partnership of getting people clean and saving lives.
That is a wonderful story. I had no idea that that was happening. And it's a great thing. What one, if I could ask you this one more thing, what one thing would you love to see if you could put it on a wish list of what would happen in our school systems that they could do differently or might add to what they're already doing to draw awareness to the severity of this problem?
I think what we need right now, not only in the school systems, but in the community as a whole, is greater access to Narcan. You know, Narcan is that, again, that drug that will give somebody a second chance. We have pilot programs right now. I'm also on the board of directors for a program called Victoria's Voice. And the board is founded in honor and memory of Victoria Siegel, the daughter of David and Jackie Siegel, who lost their daughter to an opioid-related overdose. They've got an educational curriculum that are in the schools. We have it in the Las Vegas school system, and then we have it here in the Seminole County school system. But this is an effort that you'll see going across the country that rewards children who abstain, that provides guidance and support. And we're so blessed with our local school board here and the relationship we have with our superintendent to be able to model that, show the success, so other school districts across the country can do the same.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
That is Sheriff Dennis Lima. So appreciate his time and his being with us on this program. We're going to have more of this special series, Opioid Awareness Month, coming up in a moment here on The Shepherd. Back again. This is our third program on the opioid crisis series that we're doing, drawing attention to this fact that it's an epidemic and it's affecting families everywhere. We've just heard from Sheriff Dennis Lima, and he talked about one of the centers, the Hope and Healing Center, that is in conjunction with Advent Health. And there are other treatment centers that we've found out about. Brittany talked to one of them, right? Joe Cordovano.
Joe was awesome. He has helped over 2,953 addicts here in Orlando alone. His facility has done a phenomenal job. It's located here in College Park, and it's faith-based addiction recoveries. Not only are people getting the help they need, like they would be at Sheriff Lima's Hope and Healing Center, but they are getting the help for their soul. They're being saved from a dark life.
And I had so much fun in this interview because it turns out that when I heard his name, I knew I had talked to this guy years ago and actually attended a lot of meetings at our church with him. Also just served at his location, although it's a different location from what they have now. Joe Cordovano and his ministry is called Fresh Start. You've been at this for a long time, so I know you've seen a lot of the evolution of the type of drugs,
right,
the impact of those drugs, and treatment for people who are trying to get free. It is hard work for them.
People are not understanding the hold that it has on us. And when I say that, I'm talking more spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, granted, it has a hold on us physically, and I got that, and it has a hold on us emotionally and mentally and stuff. But I'm going to be real honest with you. Like I tell my guys that are in our program, every time I get up and teach, I try to let them know that if there's nothing else to be grateful for that day, I ask them, did anybody use today? And nobody obviously raises their hand. And I said, well, that's something to be grateful for, because back in the day when we were in our, and I say we because I am a former addict of 40-something years mm-hmm. clean, but, you know, it's very difficult to break more of the mental part of this than it is the physical part.
You know, we find from the whole science of drugs, the way it does affect the mind, some people describe it as almost a rewiring of our brain. It's almost,
exactly.
It's almost like it forms new neurons and new channels between the way the brain works and the way that the brain makes for a call out, kind of a signal to the body, says, you got to have this. And I know in the drug culture, there's a phrase that says, I was jonesing. I was, I was basically needing a fix.
Right.
And the body does that. The body gives you those impressions that if you don't do this, you're in real trouble right now.
Correct. I try to keep things as simple as I can possibly keep them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't teach these guys all kinds of big words and the whole neuroscience in that aspect
mm-hmm.
as a doctor or a scientist would teach them. So I keep it pretty simple, and it's real simple. Think, feel, act. We think a thought, then we have certain feelings over it. Most people think, well, I have the feelings, and then I think, never happens that way. You're always thinking about something first, then you get feelings, and then you act out on those prior two things. The good news is that we can think of, let's say a negative thought I want to use. I can think that thought. I can feel the euphoric recall of wanting to use and all that. But that's where we can stop it with the help of Jesus Christ.
Yes, because he tells us that we can bring every thought captive.
Amen.
And that is something that no matter what the body is saying, no matter the call out that you're feeling in your heart, God is greater than all of that. And it is in those moments that we have to remember that. And that's our hope in the treatment phase of this, is that people will open their heart in faith, their mind in faith to the Lord, who can be and who wants to be an ever-present help for them.
Well, exactly. And that's what we do at Fresh Start. People kind of get confused by my title because I call myself Pastor Joe. I mean, not that I call myself, I'm ordained.
Mm-hmm.
But the first thing that comes out of everybody's mouth is, well, what church do you pastor?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I don't exactly pastor a conventional church. I pastor the sheep in God's flock that are maimed and got the mange and, you know, have been a little crippled. And I said, those are the ones that God gives me. It's my job or our job at the center to try to put them back together again. And we've been doing that for about 35 or 36 years or something like that.
Joe, you told me something back in the 90s that I've never forgotten. You said it this way. You said that oftentimes why people aren't more successful at breaking out of an addiction is that they don't really go to the root. You said that they tend to trade one addiction for another. A person who is given to the addictive lifestyle, it's easy for them to flip and they'll think, great, I can not do this. But they don't realize they've just flipped into an addiction that is now being fulfilled by something else. And that was back in the 90s. That's still true today, isn't it?
Yeah, it's still true. And again, you know, there's been a lot of material and books and research and all kinds of things. But I'm going to be honest with you, Mike. We've gotten smarter and more technical and we understand the brain more. But in reality, it's very simple. It's that. As you stated earlier, we get a thought and then that electrical impulse, let's say, in our brain travels to another, let's say A and B, travels mm-hmm. to B. And so we get a thought, I'd like to use drugs. And then that thought process, that impulse goes to B, let me go get drugs.
And that is the receptor.
Right. And so you know, very simply, what we try to do is not by getting into their heads or anything else, but just try to give them information about Jesus Christ so that when they get thought A, I'd like to do drugs, they have some other options to go to, obviously in our case, Christian options, the Bible and stuff, and they can go there. And what happens is it's almost kind of like, you know, like when you walk on a lawn in the same spot all the time, you kind of cut a rut in the sod or whatever, or in the grass. Well, it's the same thing with our brain. This is how simple it is. We've done this A to B our way so many times. It's kind of like cut a rut in our brain, if I could be extremely simplistic. Mm-hmm. And so we have got to kind of get out of that rut, go another route, and cut a new, make a more positive choice and a more positive response, and actually cut a whole nother rut. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, then the old rut begins to heal. I think I'm pretty sure the Bible calls that renewing of the mind.
Yes, it does. That's exactly what's happening. And, you know, there are so many spiritual. I love the fact that you brought the spiritual aspect in, because it is more than just physical. It is more than just emotional. We are spiritual people. We are able and open. And thank God that He does call us out of darkness.
Amen.
Into a marvelous light. And that's the hope that we have in this whole battle against opioids. What a delightful chat I had with an old friend, Joe Cordovano from Fresh Start Ministries. We're going to have more on our special series, Opioid Awareness Month, coming up in a moment. This is The Shepherd. Welcome back to our program on opioids. This is Opioid Awareness Month. Just as a reminder, we're doing this aiming at next Saturday, that's the 24th, which has been called National Drug Take Back Day. Our final guest during the interview that I had with this man, he shared so many things, and rightly so, because he deals with it as an emergency room physician. Dr. Jason Wilson is over in the Tampa area. And you know, JC, he had some amazing things, some really sobering facts about opioids.
He did, yeah. And primarily that being that, you know, many people, if they don't reach out, if they don't get help, they're headed for one of three outcomes, and that's hepatitis C, AIDS, or death.
You know, when he talked about that, it's really, to a lot of people, I believe it's a hard jump to think, how can I go from getting overly, let's say, addicted to, many people would even say they're addicted, but overly right. dependent on, but they are addicted. When they're dependent on these prescription drugs, they'd say, how does that open the door to something like hepatitis C or AIDS? What's up with that? And he shared the fact that these are gateway drugs and they don't leave you just using them.
And the other part that I think is eye-opening about our interview series this month is that, remember, we heard Kyle Baldry talk about the way that people have this misconception that opioids somehow make you, you know, sky high. And he's like, for many people, it gets them back to normal. Mm-hmm. So that makes it even more difficult to identify an addiction when it's, I just want to get to normal. How's this different from people who have to have coffee in the mornings?
Right. You know? Yep, that's true. And that normal is a very dangerous normal. Mm. And it leads them, whether they think, you know, it's like a sliding scale. Normal is getting more and more dangerous all the time for them. And that's why we're drawing attention to this. Dr. Jason Wilson, as a physician, especially one who works in the emergency room, I'm sure you've seen more than your share of sad stories and the impact that this drug and these drugs have made in people, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and you brought up the ongoing COVID pandemic, and you know, in many ways, these are not unrelated in terms of how they affect different lives, because a lot of that effect is, you know, certainly because of other structural and social things that are going on in our world. And in addition, you know, what we have seen is that many of these things with the opioid epidemic have continued or been magnified during this past year. That has not gone away. We continue to see people hurt by the opioid crisis. And in my practice, you know, this last over decade, I've really seen what that crisis looked like change over time, you know, being driven by a prescription drug crisis, then being driven by some decrease in the supply of those drugs. But people were dependent on the drugs, moving to the streets to find heroin and other drugs like that. And then now, you know, a mix of a number of different synthetic opioids and traditional opioids as well. So really seeing a change in that. And just like COVID at this point in the crisis, it's really unlikely that any family does not have somebody who's been impacted and affected by this opioid crisis.
That is so true. And so often, the first, I guess you could say, evidence or word to some family members that their loved one has a problem with it is when there's some sort of an overdose. And that becomes when they find out that this thing is a lot bigger problem than what they ever dreamed. And in some scenarios, it's too late by that point. And that's what is so tragic. And that, again, is why we are working hard to draw attention to it and to actually encourage all of our listeners to take part in the National Drug Take Back Day, which is coming up on the 24th of April, where a lot of family members who have these prescription drugs that are just kind of hanging around their medicine cabinets and maybe in drawers, and they've forgotten they're even there. But oftentimes these are discovered by family members and they are taken, stolen, if you will, and used illegally, yes, but tragically, sometimes used in a scenario that leads to their death. And so that's the worst of it all. What we're aiming for today is to find out from you what breakthroughs, if you could call them that, or what inroads have been made in the medical community that's going to help these that are suffering from this. And it can be anywhere on that palette of where people are and where the treatment centers, what they've been doing. What are you seeing right now that comes to the top of your mind, as I mentioned that treatment centers are starting now to employ?
You know, you mentioned both overdoses and you mentioned sort of pills and drugs hanging around houses. Just imagine if we could replace all those pills and drugs with naloxone, nasal spray naloxone that people are trained to use, and take away some stigma in patients who maybe aren't ready to fully quit using opioids or haven't gotten to that place in their pathway, but we had naloxone, available widely. We know that naloxone saves lives in overdoses. We know that, people who are not trained medically can use naloxone. And we've really tried to emphasize getting naloxone out. Narcan is the brand name of that. Narcan out to as many families as possible that enter into our space, either in the ED or out in our mobile units doing work. And that's kind of part of a larger harm reduction strategy. And harm reduction, I think, especially in the ED setting, is not something we thought about for a really long time in the emergency department. We really thought of ourselves as acute care managers or acute event managers. But this idea of prevention, preventing something down the line or doing something else and getting people to quit using opioids wasn't really in our purview, I think, up until recently. But as we've seen more and more families impacted, seen hepatitis C also rise because of this. We've realized we have opportunity, just like we do with tobacco cessation or wearing seatbelts or anything else in the public health landscape, to try to start making a difference. And Narcan was one of those first things that we did. And, that was a great program to start with because it was something that physicians were comfortable with and families needed those tools, and patients who maybe weren't willing to engage in quitting could still take something home that could save a life. And we've been actually sending people home with Narcan for a long time now and having them send back anonymous postcards anytime that the Narcan is used. And it's pretty amazing because every time we get one of those, our team knows that we likely saved a life. Moving on,
explain, if you will, just for a second, if you could elaborate on exactly how that drug is used properly and what it does in the process.
Yeah, of course. And I think it's something that families out there listening should know. I really think it's something that probably is worth having, around every home, just in case kind of a thing. Even from prescription medication, you just never know. And it's something that can be easily used. The nasal spray. So if you can figure out how to use an allergy nasal spray that's over the counter, you can figure this out, right? So they're not hard to do because it's over the counter. You're not going to cause any harm by these drugs because, if there's no opioid on board, there's nothing that Narcan is going to do. there's really no contraindications, really nobody you can't give it to.
Mm-hmm.
And then it may save a life. If somebody's overdosed and they're unresponsive, what the Narcan does, it actually competes with the same receptor that opioids bind to, but it binds much more strongly to that receptor and knocks the opioid off pretty dramatically, actually, very dramatically. If anybody's seen this before, knocks the opioid receptor off, and basically the respiratory depression that likely occurred is reversed. So it's really called reversal agent for that reason. And patients begin breathing again, and it definitively saves lives. So it's been pretty amazing to see, and we see the postcards come in, and we feel, you know, very humbled and know that we're doing good, and that keeps our mission moving. You know, and Narcan was a good start, but what we really, really recognized in the emergency department setting was that there was basically a huge gap between this time period that patients presented in crisis and this, you know, lack of reality that patients probably weren't going to be able to obtain follow-up care or get any type of treatment if they were still in crisis, meaning a patient presented. And I guess I kind of think of them in three different, you know, kind of groups, right? Acute overdose, withdrawal, or, you know, withdrawal-like symptoms, or ongoing drug use but not ready to quit. And we really only had something for the overdose patient, but even that was just, you know, reversing the symptoms. What we really needed to do was to find pathways to take care of patients in each of those groups. Over the past 3 or 4 years, our team has really designed and built out those pathways and changed the culture in emergency medicine to think about initiating that treatment, stabilizing patients, and linking their care into downstream partner facilities, which have become a huge part of our care process now. So if we take kind of our, I'd say, gold standard piece here, it's the patient who enters the ER now in withdrawal. 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we'd have basically given that patient a sheet of paper that had a couple of names of clinics and said, good luck, hope you have a nice life.
Mm.
And we know now definitively from data they did not have a nice life. We know now definitively from data that those patients actually had a very high mortality rate, probably approaching 10% in 1 year. That's higher than a heart attack or higher than a stroke, a very high mortality rate. So we figured out we needed to do something about it. Patients kept on coming in with opioid use disorder. So instead, what we've started to really think about doing is how can we stabilize that patient, get them out of withdrawal in the emergency department, and then work with partner facilities to link them to care. So we call that medication for opioid use disorder, or the older term, which is sort of moving away from now, is medication-assisted treatment. I say we're moving away from that term because, you know, when a patient comes in with diabetes, don't make insulin, we give them insulin. We don't say it's an assisted treatment. We say that is the treatment. And, you know, from the data we've seen, it seems pretty clear that adding, you know, medication support, especially at that pivotal phase of withdrawal and crisis, seems to save lives and seems to keep people stable and, you know, able to make it to partner facilities. So over these past few years, we have gone from zero buprenorphine waiver physicians. And what does that mean? That means that you have to have a special tag on your DEA license that says you can prescribe buprenorphine or Suboxone, which is the drug that helps people who have opioid use disorder, which is ironic because I don't have to have any special tags on my license to prescribe fentanyl or Vimodid. I can send you home with, you know, all the fentanyl you want. That I want to send you home with no special training or tag, but just to prescribe the life-saving medicine right now, as we speak anyway, I do have to do that to get that medicine.
Could you explain why? Why would that be the case? It makes no sense.
It doesn't, and there is some work going on right now by the current Surgeon General and this administration to look into ways to perhaps lessen those burdens. When the drug had first come out, it is a type of opioid, and it's a, at least it works on opioid pathways. I wouldn't say it's a type of opioid. It works on opioid pathways. And so it was a new type of drug. But again, we hadn't really seen that done with any other medication. So you're right. In many ways, many of us feel it makes no sense. Let me just be clear about that. I think that many of us in this community really wish that would go away because what it basically does is it creates an extra layer of bureaucracy and paperwork which keeps providers from getting that ability to, you know, manage patients. Now, you know, part of the reasoning for it was thinking about long-term management of a patient with, you know, opioid use disorder. But what the unforeseen side effect was is that it kept people from stabilizing patients with opioid use disorder. So that means that in an ER setting, you had very few people who'd be willing to give Suboxone to patients to go home with. So a few years ago, we started kind of looking at the law, the you know, DEA law, and we realized you could actually give the medication in the ER. You could actually give it three times in the ER if the patient came back. She's going to give a prescription for it.
Mm-hmm.
So we started there, actually, and we had really good success. We found out that we were able to get people, we use a score, we use a stratified scoring system for withdrawal. It's called the CAL score, the clinical opioid withdrawal score. And we can move people in very heavy withdrawal, 22, 23 is a very high number, down to 4, down to 3, which is a very comfortable number for a patient. We can get them there with a dose of this buprenorphine or Suboxone, the brand name. And then we could directly link them to a provider, a community provider in our area. And this was incredible because we really had not developed those types of relationships with community providers in the past. We had them on a piece of paper. We knew their names, but we didn't know them. We didn't know what happened to patients when they went there. We didn't know, you know, how the patient was doing or have any shared feedback between us. They didn't know what we did in the ER. We didn't know what they did there. That's drastically changed, you know, a few years into this. That has drastically changed. We have weekly meetings, my team and our, we have about 3 community facilities that we use. And, you know, we give a lot of latitude to what happens to the patient once they arrive there, because they do have addiction trained psychiatrists there, and this is their area of expertise. So some of our patients remain on buprenorphine or Suboxone. Some of the patients move over to methadone. Some of the patients are admitted inpatient. Most are not. Most stay outpatient. And some, you know, discontinue use of, you know, any type of other medication altogether. And some don't, which is okay, too, because those are all better than dying and better than being on opioids.
Mm-hmm.
And then, right? And that's something I think is really important for the public to understand. You know, we're not just replacing one opioid with another. We're replacing an opioid with a pretty harmless medicine like Suboxone that a patient can take once a day and not have all those problems that come with addiction, which, you know, affect your relationships, your economics, your job, your whole life, right? And affects your health. So we've seen, along with this opioid epidemic, another epidemic of hepatitis C in young people. Hepatitis C is particularly a bad infectious disease because you have liver cancer, liver failure that come with it. And we've worked really hard now to try to get people on treatment, because if they get on treatment, for their opioid use disorder, then it's less likely they'll share needles. It's less likely they'll transmit hepatitis C to other people. And even more recently, what we've tried to do is actually initiate treatment for hepatitis C at the same time that we're initiating treatment for opioid use disorder, trying to treat both conditions at one time and really make an impact on spreading the disease to other people and also helping that patient as well.
Are you seeing any, let's say, statistical evidence that would point that any particular age group are really responding well to these initiatives that you're doing?
Yeah, so that's actually a great question. So I think our real struggle, and if you go back in the past, was that age group that sort of sits in the young 20s to young 30s. And the reason for that was, you know, not only just normal young person risk-taking behavior and all those kind of things, but also that's a patient population that is in general lost to care often, right? You're often between insurance of your parents and kind of establishing your own sort of economic life. You're kind of floating in between those two spaces, right, in that time period of your life. And so we really found a lot of those patients were slipping through the cracks because there wasn't a clear place for them to go. And they didn't necessarily have, you know, a private insurer or something to help pay for things. So we have, both by the epidemic's nature and also by the gap, concentrating those patients, you know, especially because one of the things that, again, drew me here was because the mounting infectious disease that came with it, with hepatitis C and HIV, which by far disproportionately affects those patient age groups. You know, we think of hepatitis C as a baby boomer virus, a baby boomer disease, but that's essentially not the case at this point, because all the new cases of hepatitis C are really in opioid use disorder patients. As a matter of fact, I tell my opioid use disorder patients that they really have a hepatitis C problem. Either they have hepatitis C now, or they're going to get hepatitis C if they keep on using, especially if they use an injection drug, which, you know, a lot of these things, that's where they'll lead to eventually. So we're trying to treat two epidemics really at the same exact time between those two disease states.
How much of the problem, if you were to try to typify percentages, how much of the problem is coming from the kind of drugs that we would be talking about, like fentanyl or oxycodone or something like that, versus what happens later on when they start injecting?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Here's the way I think about it. It's a journey. And it's a journey that you have different places in that road to intervene in. You know, essentially, the journey's left to itself. The journey is going to lead to either death or injection drug use, and then eventually probably hepatitis C, and probably eventually death, right? Mm. That's the journey. And so it depends on where I'm seeing that patient in their pathway. You know, because what happens eventually with opioids is that your body develops essentially, it gets used to essentially the same dosing of opioid, right? So if patient starts out, maybe they take a Percocet and they have, you know, some effect from that Percocet. Well, a month after that, all of a sudden they have to have a Percocet and a half or two Percocets.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now they're blowing through a bottle of Percocet, you know, pretty quickly, and that's getting pretty expensive. But then somebody mentions to them, hey, you know, if you crush that Percocet up, you know, and put in your mucous membranes anywhere in your body, I'll let you figure where those are at. You put it there, and then it'll really start to absorb much quicker.
Wow.
That works a little bit, but then maybe it doesn't. Maybe that effect starts to die down. You're blowing through more Percocet, right? So then maybe you have to crush and snort it, get right to the blood-brain barrier. Maybe that works for a little while, but maybe that effect stops. You're starting to blow through more bottles of Percocet again. So what comes next? Well, then it's usually injection drug use.
Mm-hmm.
And then injection drug use, once you tip into that pocket, the problem is now you're going to have lots of medical consequences as well, right? So not only just all the other things that are happening with the normal addiction of a pill version of opioid, but now with injection drugs, right, you've got not only are your veins and skin from, you know, poking yourself, are you getting scar tissue? You have a risk for skin infections, skin and soft tissue infections. That's really the vast majority of if you're not a diabetic and you're not over the age of 60, basically skin and soft tissue infections are from, you know, injection drug use in an urban ER like ours. So you start to get those infections can go into the bloodstream and cause bloodstream infections called sepsis. They can go into the heart and cause what's called endocarditis, which is a very serious disease, which can eat up the heart valve. And it can go into the bone and cause osteomyelitis. And then, like I mentioned earlier, cause HIV and hepatitis C, which we very prominently see amongst groups of, and this actually is a good thing to get back to harm reduction for a second, because what we really do see is that people have to get their needles from somewhere. And so they will inject for a while, and then they will need needles, and they will start to, since the way the world kind of works right now, the easiest place to get needles is from each other. From other people who are injecting drugs. Well, I mentioned earlier that, you know, those patients often have hepatitis C or HIV. And hepatitis C specifically, unfortunately, is really virulent. It's really good at sticking on all that stuff of drug use, the needles, the pipes, spoons, the cloth, everything. And so it transmits quickly through those networks of people. So the most recent thing that we've really emphasized here in this area, and we're actually the second county now to have a fully functioning harm reduction effort, is essentially a sterile syringe program. So Miami has one, and Hillsborough County has one that we operate with USF, where essentially we are trying to meet people where they're at, recognizing we'd love to get all patients off of opioids. But in the meantime, we would like to keep hepatitis C from spreading, HIV spreading, and people to stay alive long enough to get off of opioids.
Mm-hmm.
So we do HIV testing, hepatitis C testing, and we try to provide clean needles to those patients in exchange for dirty needles to try to decrease the amount of hepatitis C that we see in our community. We've been doing that since January of this year. Miami's been doing it for about a year and a half. And, you know, it's amazing. Even since January, we've already picked up about five people with HIV who didn't know they had HIV, who were going to share needles with other people with opioid use disorder and give them HIV. We picked up about 10 people with hepatitis C. And so we've been able to directly link those people to care. We've been able to get the hepatitis C patients on the hepatitis C treatment. And we've been able to get at least half of those people off of opioids and onto those medications like we talked about earlier, like buprenorphine or Suboxone. So no longer injecting and now using a pill form. But there's other five, you know, that we haven't gotten onto those medicines yet. At least now they're not, you know, using dirty needles and spreading hepatitis C throughout our community.
I just can only imagine you've had some criticism pointed your way because you're actually giving addicts needles to use to get drugs. But if it's lost on them, the reason why you're doing that, it would be understandable why they would have that question. But basically, you're preventing the spread of not only hepatitis C, but basically AIDS and potential death by those two things. These aren't items that you normally would, and certainly not going into this study, had I really made a connection between hepatitis C and opioids. But right. From a treatment center standpoint, it's just the next step in the road.
Yeah, if you just go on Google Image, right, type in like opioid hepatitis C, you'll see those curves look exactly the same. They are the exact same curves. They start in 2009. They start in 20 to 30, 20 to 40 year olds, and they go up at the same rate. They are together co-epidemics. Now, let me go back to the other point, too. Look, we want everyone to be off of opioids. We do not want people to be using opioids, but we also recognize we can't get everyone to stop using opioids today. But what we can do is develop relationships with patients. What we can do is develop trust with patients. And we can, and what we can do is offer them testing, and we can offer them a way to not infect other people. We can offer them naloxone training. We can offer them naloxone and Narcan to take home and save lives. And hopefully we can eventually get all those patients into treatment. As we get them treated for their hepatitis C, we can get some of them moved over to the buprenorphine clinic as well, which we've done. Again, at least 50% of these patients would be on no treatment right now if it wasn't because of the outreach of the harm reduction program, who've now come into treatment because of that outreach. Mm-hmm. So sure, the idea is to get 100%, you know, from off of all opioids. And that is the goal always. But we got to meet people where they're at.
You know, with any trend, like an epidemic that's going deeper and deeper, and then when you reverse that, the goal is to see more and more evidence that there is a, let's say, a positive, not positive drug use, but a positive direction coming out of that drug use. And it sounds like you're seeing some of that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think, let me put this in a couple of different buckets for you. One, I think from a physician wellness, sort of joy of what we like to do is take care of people and relieve suffering. By adding this ability to take care of people with opioid use disorder, that's something we weren't doing 5 years ago. And watching in front of us as we get those people feeling better and get those people engaged in care has been just as gratifying to many physicians as it is to take care of a heart attack patient or a stroke patient. That's been incredible.
Dr. Jason Wilson from Tampa, we so appreciate him and all of our guests. Next week, our final episode on Opioid Awareness Month. Thanks for being with us here on Afternoons with Mike.